Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find several speaker feeds with over 400 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Michael.
Hello, everybody. My name's Michael. I'm a compulsive overeater and bulimic. It's good to be here in a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Last time I stood in front of you, I got it wrong and said the other program, but here I am. And I do thank God for my abstinence and my sobriety. Every morning I get up, I get on my knees, and I thank Him from the bottom of my heart for the 12 steps and Overeaters Anonymous. I've got an incredible life today, and I'm going to share that with you and share a lot of solution with you today. And I just want to welcome all the newcomers. Was it 6 short years ago when I came in here? And I remember the seat that I sat in two seats at the time because I was 300 plus pounds and it was right at the back there. And I was a broken man, you know, I was really a broken man. And my life was really out of control and I didn't really know what else to do. And I found my way into this room. And this room is very special for me because this is where it all started for me. This incredible journey, and I want to welcome the newcomers because you are the most important people in this room, and we've got to make a big fuss of you at the end, so don't leave too early. And I say that because people made a lot of a big fuss of me and really put their hand out to me. And Mickey, every time I see Mickey, I just remember how kind he was to me when I came in here, and a lot of people were very kind to me. And you know, I owe my life to this room and this program. And I want to welcome my friend Jim, who I've got to know first time at OA, and I'm glad you're here, Jim. And I was just thinking about this driving over here. You know, I don't have any toxic people in my life, you know. There's no drama in my life. My life's quite boring, actually. it's not boring, but there's no drama in my life, and there's no toxic people in my life. And, you know, I just have a really good life, you know, and for the most part, I'm very peaceful and calm inside. And that, to me, is recovery. That really is, for me, recovery. And happy birthday, Andrea. And David, happy birthday. It's really good to have got to know you over the last couple of years. And, you know, you're inspirational. You know, the things you've been through, and you're here today to stand up and take that candle for 2 years. And before I get into my story and into my solution, I want to thank Erin for doing all the service and Ed around the podcast, because the podcasts of this meeting are really very powerful. And 5.5 years ago, we nearly stopped having the podcast at this meeting. I don't even know if some of you know the story. And it was Walter G, my first sponsor, who really pulled me out of a dark hole. And he was adamant that we keep the podcast here. And I was like, Walter, you seem really, you know, obsessed about these podcasts. Why do we have to keep these podcasts? And he said, the message in this room is going to go, you know, far and wide. And last year I had the opportunity to travel to different states and go to OA meetings and retreats. I was asked to go to Arizona and share my story, and I was up there in Northern California and Central California, and I even got out invited all the way out to Montana. So I do want to say hello to all my friends in Montana, Nadine, and I know this is in Rosie out in Arizona, and all the people in Overeaters Anonymous of Great Britain that emailed me as well. And it was funny, I went to this tiny little hotel somewhere up in northern Montana to meet this group of women to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I walked in, and at the first break they came up to me and they said, do you know Leslie E? And do you know Lee San? And do you know Martha? And I said, well, I know Martha quite well, yeah. And they said, have you got the telephone numbers? And I looked through my phone, and I said, yeah, I've got them. And they were talking about these women in light a candle, like they knew them. And I forgot for a minute. I said, well, how do you know these people? They're in Los Angeles in the podcast. So that's how powerful these podcasts are. And I know Rachel sponsors a lady up there in Montana through these podcasts and through the connection we've met there. So these podcasts really, really do work. But the thing is, nobody invited me back last year, so I couldn't have been very good. I got invited to all these places. So I'm just letting you know there, Montana. You never got. And Arizona. Northern California. I couldn't have been that good. The accent wore off after a day, and then, well, I've heard all this before, so hopefully I'll do a better job today. So, you know, going back to what it was like, it was probably... And Katie, thank you for asking me, and thank you for being such an inspiration, and, you know, getting to know you in the last few months as well. And, you know, the eating disorder is, it's horrendous. You know, it's horrendous. I'm an alcoholic as well. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'm very active in AA as well. But the eating is, it just takes on a whole new meaning of addictions to me. It really does, because this last 7 days have been a real struggle for me, because I've been working in Las Vegas, and Las Vegas for me is probably the worst place it could be for a compulsive overeater, bulimic, alcoholic. There's every single trigger known to man there, and I had to spend 7 days at Caesar's Palace working 12 hours a day, and every morning I'd get up and I would come down the elevator, and I'd come onto the main floor, and as I walked through the floor, on the left-hand side, there was this crepes place that did all these crepes, right, chocolate crepes, and they'd be, like, throwing these crepes up in the air, and then on the other side, there was this candy shop that had every single candy known to man, and it had a lot of British candy, and, you know, I'd be, like, looking on my left-hand side, and then my right-hand side, and then straight in front of me is Las Vegas's best buffet. And I could smell the food as I was walking through to the gym. I was going to the gym. the guys that I work with are those kind of people that can eat with impunity. Mm-hmm. You know, don't they make you sick? Yeah. And every morning we'd go and have a workout, and they'd always want to go in the buffet. And, you know, they'd be ordering the huge big breakfast, and I would have the same thing every morning. I'd have that egg white omelette and spinach, no bread, and tea without milk. And I saw them looking at my breakfast every morning, and I always get asked why I don't drink, being Scottish. Why don't you drink? So I always have to navigate that one, and then I always get asked, why do you eat so healthily all the time? What is wrong with you? You know, and I've got a friend at work who's very close. I'm close to him, and I've got to know him and his wife pretty well. And he was asking me, you know, on about the fourth morning, he was asking me. I don't know if you ever get this, but it gets really tiresome when people keep asking you why you always eat the way you eat, and why you don't drink, why you don't gamble, you know. And I told him. I felt compelled to tell him about, you know, what I was. And I told him, about my history. And I said, you know, I used to weigh 333 pounds. That was, and he went, you, and he couldn't believe it, you know. And then I told him a little bit about my alcoholism and being in AA and in OA, and you know, normies find it fascinating, you know. And it was a good thing to do, but it was also for the rest of the day, he kept asking me questions about it. You know, I trust him implicitly, and it just felt, you know, it felt good to be able to tell somebody that, you know, out with the program. It just did. It just felt the right thing to do. And, you know, the miracle of OA is that I got through 7 days in Las Vegas and ate healthily and got up every morning and worked out and did my prayers and managed to call people in program, called my sponsor every day, and came back and was peaceful and sane. In Las Vegas for a whole 7 days. Now, to me, that is miraculous. You know, that's the application of this program and the application of these steps. And I live in steps 10, 11, and 12. And I'll talk a little bit about the steps later. But, you know, this is the miracle of it. So the reason why I'm telling you this story is basically, if you're really struggling today with the food, whether you've been coming to OA a long time or whether you've just walked in the door, there is a solution. And the smallest paragraph in the big book is the best paragraph, and it says it works. It really does. Mm-hmm. And it does. It really does work. And I tell my own sponsees that, you know, if you really do go for this, no half measures, and you really try and change your character, because it really is a change of character, and it's really not about food. And if you really go and you work these steps and you try and apply these steps in your life and you give back, then the food will become insignificant to you. And you'll get to the weight that you want to be, and you'll feel comfortable, and you'll feel peaceful, and you'll you'll find your way in this life. And I honestly do believe that. And that's what I've found in the last 6 years. So, you know, going back a little bit to my story, you know, my earliest memory of compulsively overeating was Friday nights. You know, I'd be waiting for my father to come back from the pub, and I knew there was always going to be a scene, and I knew that my mother was going to get it, you know. And I grew up in this alcoholic home, and you know, I just remember my father dragging my mother across the floor by the head of her hair, and I was 7 years of age, and I couldn't do anything about it. And I used to run upstairs, and I would hide under the covers, and I would hoard chocolate under my bed, and I would eat this chocolate under my covers, and it just made me feel better. And it took all the fear and the anxiety away, and, you know, that was the first thing I found to kind of handle all the situations that I found myself in. And as I got into my teens, I got really into sport. It was kind of, you know, I was really into soccer, football, we call it where I come from, and rugby. You know, I played a lot of sport, and I got really good at it, and I went away and played, you know, college soccer, and, you know, but I had this eating disorder that was growing and building and growing and getting stronger in my teens. And, you know, I would be hiding chocolate and hiding food, and, you know, I would be, you know, working out, throwing up at the end of it, and I thought that was normal and healthy. You know, I'd go out running, and I'd run so hard, you know, and I'd throw up down the front of my shirt, and I'd hide the vomit-stained shirt in the garage, and I'd go in and I'd put a fresh shirt on, and I would, you know, these behaviours went on and on and on, and I had no idea that I was suffering from bulimia. I had no idea what that was. I just knew I liked food. Everybody liked food where I came from. You know, I come from a country that deep-fry Mars bars and eat them, you know. And, you know, that's where I come from. Fish suppers and a deep-fried Mars bar and a bottle of lemonade, you know. Overeaters Anonymous in Scotland know exactly what I'm talking about as they're listening to this podcast. And that's, you know, that was the way I grew up. And then alcohol played a huge part in my story as well. You know, everybody drank. And I didn't like the taste of alcohol at first. I really didn't, but I loved the effect it had on me, you know, after that second drink. And I used to drink to not eat, and I used to eat to not drink. And I couldn't get through a single day without either eating or drinking. And this went on and on and on and on until, you know, I always wanted to come to America. You know, I was fascinated by America, and I first came here. I was playing soccer at college, and I had the opportunity to come to America in 1992 to come and coach and play. And I came over to Boston, and, you know, the food was still there and the alcohol was still there, but I had a lot of purpose in my life. You know, I was very excited about my life, and I was playing soccer, and I would... playing soccer every day. I kept in good shape so I could hide that compulsive eating, and I was still throwing up. Nobody knew about it, but I just had a lot of purpose, so it wasn't really taking on, you know, the kind of dangerous effects that it later did. And then I came back here 12, 13 years ago, and it really just took over, you know. And I found myself in a strange city without a job, without any friends, and you know, very lonely, and there was alcohol and food, and it just took control of me, and I just got bigger and bigger and bigger, you know. And I was obese, and I couldn't even look in the mirror in the morning when I got up. You know, I'd get into the shower, and I just couldn't look at it. I couldn't look at myself, and you know, I was constantly on my own, always on my own, you know. And I would, Friday nights, I was living in Pasadena, and I would, you know, a typical Friday night for me would be, you know, going to a diner and stuffing my face. You know, I could hardly fit into the booth, and, you know, coming out of the diner and throwing up down the side of my car and vowing that I wouldn't do it again. You know, that is the last time, I'm never going to do this again. You know, and I couldn't tell anybody. You know, being a man and bulimic is the hardest thing, you know. You know, bulimia seems to be a disease associated with women and gay men. It just is. I haven't met many straight male bulimics, you know, I really haven't. And I had nobody to talk to. Nobody. I couldn't share this with anybody. And, you know, it just got out of hand. And, you know, I just remember, they say in AA, remember your last drunk. I can remember my last binge. And it was a Sunday morning in January 2008. And I just remember that I couldn't vomit anymore. I just, my body had given up doing that. And I was this huge obese man, and I was sitting in this dingy apartment in Pasadena, clinging on to a job, And, you know, I just thought, is this the American dream? You know, I came to this country. No, I'm being serious. But, you know, I came to this country, I had this dream of being successful and doing well. And, you know, this is where it had taken me to, you know. And I'd heard about OA, and I typed in eating disorders into Google. And it came back with Overeaters Anonymous in it. And I'd already been to one AA meeting. And I went out, and I looked on the meeting list, and I found there was a men's stag in Glendora on a Sunday night. And the name, the contact name, was a guy called Daryl. And I called him. I'd come to the end of the road. I could not go on. And I called him, and his friendly voice picked the phone up. And he said, yeah, come out, you know, come and meet me, and I'll introduce you to some of the men. And he was just so friendly. And I went out there, and it was the strangest story, my first OA meeting. You know, I walked in, I've shared this before, but I walked into my first OA meeting, this old rickety OA clubhouse in Glendora. And I got there 20 minutes early, and there was nobody there. Oh wait, nobody turned up till 5 minutes before. Just kidding. AA were there an hour before. Oh wait, 5 minutes before. So anyway, except for light a candle, I walked in and I sat down, and there was one guy there, and he was lying in the middle of the floor. This guy. And I mean, can you imagine a newcomer? I didn't know what to do, and I knew I was that desperate that I didn't turn around. I just came in, and he sat up when he saw me, and he said, "You believe in God?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Good," and laid back down again. And I was terrified. I just didn't know what to do. So I sat down, and in came this guy called Daryl and a couple of other guys, and they made me feel so welcome. And I just felt better. I just felt better, you know. And an amazing story. I never met Daryl. I went, oh, and he told me about this meeting, light a candle meeting. And he said, there's an Irish guy there called Mickey. And go over there, and there's some young people, and they go for a coffee afterwards, and it's in Brentwood. It's a great meeting. So I came the following Saturday to the Brentwood meeting, and I've been coming ever since. And the funny thing about this guy Daryl, I never saw him again for years until 5.5 years ago, and they asked me to go back to that old rickety OA clubhouse and speak on the 25th anniversary of the Foothill over whatever it was. And I walked in, and it was all women. And I walked in, and you know, I did my pitch and made them laugh and told them how great my life was and always the greatest thing ever. And you know, and he walked in halfway through my share as I was telling the story about the guy lying in the middle of the floor. He walked in, Daryl. You know Daryl, don't you? And he sat down, and I went, "That's the guy who picked the phone up." And he looked at me, and he just didn't recognize me. Which is such a great thing, you know, that he didn't recognize me, right? Been problems if he had recognized me. So, these little things that happen in OA are just, you know, God-given, you know, God-given. So, I found my way into Overeaters Anonymous, and I knew very quickly that I'd found the solution to what I'd been looking for most of my life, all of my life. And I found a sponsor that was in AA and OA, and he had everything that, you know, all the problems that I had, and he had a solution to it. And this guy, Walter, took me to all these meetings, AA, OA. He just took me all over the place. And he made me do a lot of service. And I didn't like doing a lot of service. You know, he made me get there early and put chairs out. And he made me go around the room shaking hands of people. And I didn't really like doing that either. But the more I did this, things got better and better and better. And I started losing the weight. And, you know, I dropped like 120 pounds in the first year. And then I started running and working out and all the good things that come with losing a lot of weight when you're obese. And the bulimia really cleared up. You know, it kind of cleared up. But he was insistent that I do a lot of service. And he was insistent that I do the steps thoroughly and I make an amends. And so, you know, off I went and, you know, I went work through the first 9 steps. And, you know, I take my own sponsees through these first 9 steps the way. And everything is out the book, you know. And I carry the big book with me everywhere. And I read it every single day. You know, it comes with me. And I bought it here. I did the literature here with Lucy for about 18 months. And I bought this little big book from here. And I write all my prayers in this book. and I carry it everywhere. And I'll give you an example of how powerful this book is. You know, last night I went to an OA meeting and I was tired, and I was feeling really lonely last night, you know, and Martha's away in Canada, and, you know, I just didn't have anybody to call, or so my mind told me. I was in a real place of alcoholism, and I just felt lonely, and the food was calling me, you know. It still calls me. I don't act on it, but it still calls me. Alcohol never calls me. Food still calls me. And I was sitting on Santa Monica Boulevard, and I was near 7-Eleven, Bundy and Santa Monica Boulevard, and the idea came into my head, it would be a good idea to go in that 7-Eleven and buy a big tub of ice cream. I mean, these are the things that go through my mind. And I pulled out my big book, and I opened it up, and it was at the part, the whiskey in the milk, Jim the car salesman. And I read that, and I've read this 100 times, the whiskey in the milk. But there was a part in the story that I read, and I'm sitting here on the side of the road reading the big book, 8:30 last night, and it says that he felt slightly irritated before he went out to visit a prospect that he was going to sell a car to, and he felt slightly irritated that the concern that he worked for used to be his business and is no longer his business. So he's in a bit of resentment there, and I've been in a bit of resentment the last couple of days. You know, why do I have to go to Las Vegas for 7 days? I'm working 14 hours a day, my boss doesn't tell me, he doesn't thank me enough, you know, alcoholic, poor me, ego, self-obsession, and this little resentment's growing. And I hadn't done a step 10 on it, you know, I hadn't done a step 10 on it. So I'm reading this, and it came to my mind that the reason why he put the whiskey in the milk was because of the resentment that he had before he even went into the sandwich shop. And when the food is calling me, there is always something behind it. These thoughts don't just come into my head. When I binged and purged, it was the state of my mind leading up to that binge or that purge. And so I have to act upon that very quickly. And I'm jumping around the steps here, but step 10 specifically tells me in the big book that I need to watch out for resentment and fear, selfishness and dishonesty. It tells me about those four things. And it's very specific in the big book. It says when these things crop up, that I need to ask God to remove them immediately. And I did, I was there, I thought, well, I'm going to pray about this, I'm going to pray, God, can you remove this resentment that I've got towards my work, my boss, and the resentment I had towards Martha. Why is she not here? Why is she in Canada? Why is she not with me? You know, she's come to visit her family, how dare she? She'd be with me. Yeah, you know? Self-obsession, selfishness. So there was resentment, there was selfishness, there was no dishonesty, you know, but there was fear. There's always fear. And so this fear's inside me. I might actually go into that 7-Eleven. Now, if you have the disease that I've got, you will completely understand that. If you're a compulsive overeater and a bulimic, you will completely understand that. Alcoholics don't understand that unless it's about alcohol. I taught them, but you guys understand it. So I prayed, and then I called my sponsor, and I told him exactly. I couldn't get hold of him, I left a message. But there's two other parts of that step 10 that take me away from the food. And it says in the big book that I have to make an amends if one is needed. Well, there wasn't an amends needed to be made. But the fourth part of it is the crucial part. And if I don't do this fourth part of the 10th step, I will go into that 7-Eleven. And it says that I resolutely turn my thoughts to someone else. Now, it's really, really easy, in my opinion, to treat an eating disorder. Very, very simple. Not easy. Very, very simple. And so I called a couple of people and asked how they were doing. One in OA, one in AA. And the thought of that ice cream and the resentments and the fear disappeared. And that's the magic of this book. I've got it, it's in my back pocket. Every day it's in my back pocket. And when I do what it tells me to do, I feel happy, joyous and free. And I don't go into that 7-Eleven and I go on with my day. And I went home. And it was kind of, you know, a bit lonely going in, no lights on, and I walked in there. And so immediately I say a prayer, and then I call Martha. And I go to bed. And I'm abstinent. And so I have to work hard at this. You know, I really dedicate myself to this, because my life is too precious. I don't want to be 330 pounds again. I don't want to be throwing up down the side of my car. I don't want to be scooping vomit out of my car. I don't want to be obsessing about the way I look. I don't want to walk into a room and feel I'm the only person there, nobody wants to talk to me. You know, I don't want to be like that. 10 minutes left. So, getting into the solution, there's one solution there. So really living in steps 10, 11 and 12 every day, that was an application of step 10. Now step 11, I do every night. Every night I write out, and it's in the big book, there's 10 things in step 11 that I write out. Prayer and meditation are really important. Now the meditation side of it, I haven't really perfected, but prayer, I don't do the bookend prayer anymore. You know, I don't get, you know, I do get on my knees in the morning, and you know, I'll read Emmett Fox. I love Emmett Fox, and I'll read the big book in the 12 and 12, and I'll ask God to be with me. But I remember to take God with me all through the day. You know, and I haven't got my watch on tonight because it broke, but typically I put my watch on the other, I'm left-handed, and I put it on my right hand. And I'll look at my watch. I was in Vegas. Why is my watch on my right hand? That's to remind me that I need to check in with He that has all power, my Creator. And I'll say the seven-step prayer in my head because it's my favourite prayer. Or I'll say the serenity prayer. I'll just simply ask Him to be with me, to help me. Can you guide me through today? Can you protect me from my thinking? Can you just be with me? Can you help me help somebody today? And when I do that, my day goes very, very well. And it takes a lot of discipline to do that. Huge amount of discipline. But, it's like anything. The more I work at it, mental habit of thought, the more I work at it, the easier it gets. And so I do remember to do this. And then at the end of the night, I write out my 11th step, you know, and the first thing is, I think it's on page 88. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. The first thing, was I resentful to anybody? And I write the names down. And sometimes there's two or three people that I'm resentful to. And then it says to me, was I selfish? I put down any incidents when I was selfish. Was I dishonest? Do I owe anybody an apology? You know, do I need to discuss something with my sponsor? One of the key things that I've learned in this program to keep me clean from the food is I have to tell my sponsor everything. There is nothing I don't keep from him. No matter how ashamed I am of what I've done, I have to tell him. And my sponsor at the moment is somebody that I trust implicitly, that works this program. I only choose people my sponsor is somebody who works this program, and I see it in his life. And so, you know, I have to trust him, and I tell him everything. You know, was I kind and loving to all? You know, that's part of step 11 as well. You know, was I kind? Did I hold the door open at Ralph's for that lady? You know, did I say good morning when I was walking down this? I have to do these things, you know, these tiny little things. Did I take my shopping cart back at the supermarket? I do these things. My sponsor gets on to me if I don't, you know. This was, was I thinking of myself most of the time, you know, and what did I do for others? That's a big one. What did I do for others? I always have to have somebody's name on my list every day. If I don't, it's going to be a bad day the following day. You know, the constant thought of others. Now, I'm not constantly thinking of you, I'm going to be honest with you. But it's getting a lot better. And I think somebody shared when they came up, you know, I'm not constantly thinking, I'm self-obsessed. Well, the progress I've made in this is that I'm not constantly thinking of me anymore. I'm not always thinking of you, but I'm not thinking of me. And to me, that's good progress for 6 years in this program. But I am thinking more and more of you, and it comes to sponsorship. And, you know, I do put my hand up, and I was talking to Jim today. You know, I sponsor men and women and gay men, you know, the full spectrum. You know, I sponsor whoever asks me to help them, I'll try and help them. And it was for about 2 years I just couldn't get anybody through the steps. It was driving me crazy. Every time I got them to the fourth step, they disappeared. You know, if I got them through the fourth step, they disappeared at the eighth step because they didn't want to do the ninth step. When they saw what I was doing at 10, 11 and 12, nobody wanted to do that. You know? And then I came across Jane. Now you probably know Jane, and you know, young Jane, and she came and asked me to sponsor her. You know, and I thought, what is she asking me for? You know, and she was the first person I got through all 12 steps, and her life has changed beyond belief. You know, I'm sure most of you know her, and she's spoken here, and she keeps in touch with me today. And from her, then it was like a domino effect. You know, more and more people, and I started getting all these people, all women, through the steps, and I was saying to Martha, I've got to find a man that wants to go through the steps, you know. So this gay guy asked me in West Hollywood, and you know, he got through it, and to this point, I haven't got a straight man through the steps. So straight men, if you want to go through the steps. please ask me. This one straight guy would be nice. Okay. And a bulimic straight guy would just be the jackpot. So that, you know, that's step 11, and then it takes me on to step 12, and step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening, you know, it sounds a bit kind of, I've had a spiritual awakening, I don't know, I have had a spiritual awakening, I don't know what that means, I just am a nicer person than I was 6 years ago, but there's a lot of work to be done yet, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. And as a result of these steps, it says, try to carry this message. You know, I do speak a lot, AA and OA, and that has its a double effect as well, because then my ego starts getting stroked a little bit, you know, and, you know, speaking more and more AA. I've done the OA circuit now, the AA, and I've got to remind myself that, you know, it's to help those when I come to a meeting and I'm sharing about my experience. It's not to gloat, not to, you know, here's my OA badge. It's to hopefully somebody in here today will ask me to take them through the steps at the end of this pitch. That's why I'm here today, to carry that message. And to, you know, but Bill, when he wrote these steps, left it right towards the end. The hardest part he left at the end, to practice these principles in all of our affairs. You know, if you're a bulimic, compulsive overeater, alcoholic, I have a lot of compassion for you, because I know the pain you've gone in. The rest of you, I don't know. You know, when you're on the 405, and you're cutting me off on the 405, sometimes it's hard to find that compassion, but I do. I have to practice these principles in all of my affairs. And I've got a job at the moment. You know, I've been working for the same company and for the last 6 years, and at the moment I'm in a position where it's helping a lot of people. You know, it's helping. I work with small, medium-sized businesses and help them get started. And you know, there is an opportunity to go and help them. And I do speak and train and coach in my job as well. And I always put little 12-step slogans in there. And on Thursday, this guy came up to me. I've done this 90-minute class in Vegas, and he came up to me and he went, You're one of us, aren't you? You're a friend of Bill. And I went, how did you guess? As I'm sipping my sparkling water talking to him. So we're everywhere, you know, we're all out there. So, you know, I'm just going to finish on this. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. Alcoholics Anonymous and Overeaters Anonymous. And this design, this way of living is just incredible. And I'm really excited for my life and the future. And I've got a lot of hope, a lot of hope. And if you've got no hope today, you know, just keep coming here and talk to people and, you know, find that person that's doing it, doing the deal. And I don't mean somebody who can stand up here and articulate the 12 steps and quote every page in the big book. I mean somebody who's really living it in their life, you know, practicing these principles in all of our affairs. And every sponsor I've had and every friend that I've got, that I meet in AA, I choose them carefully. I choose them very carefully, because I need to have good people in my life, because I learn from them. So I think that's all I've got. It's good to see everybody, and see you next year, Montana. Hopefully. All right. Okay, thanks. We got time for a question? All right. Who wants to ask a question? I've traveled internationally where my structure, what was
the food?
The food is out of my control. Yeah, I've been back to the UK, back to Scotland and England a couple of times, and I travel a lot domestically and over to Canada as well. But when I'm traveling, is the most challenging aspect, whether I'm abroad or whether I'm in the States. And you're asking me how I deal with that. Mm-hmm. The tools of OA are very effective to me. What I do is my iPhone, I write down everything that I eat during the day, and if I keep on track of that, it's just a real good tool to have. Where I write, you know, I type in an email to myself of exactly what I've eaten. Even if it's messy, I still put it in, because as an alcoholic, compulsive overeater, I'm indisciplined. It says it in the big book, and I need God to help discipline me. And that's a tool that helps me. I also make calls to people. Airports are particularly difficult for me. I was at Vegas Airport yesterday without breakfast, and I need breakfast. I couldn't find anywhere that had anything healthy to eat in the entire airport. I walked up and down. So in the end, I just had a coffee and a fruit cup from Starbucks, and I sat and opened up my big book. This really helps when I'm traveling. Open it up and I read it. And I've got a prayer for you, which I'm going to quickly, if I've got time. It's an OA prayer. And I forgot to mention it earlier. I say this prayer to myself when I'm traveling. It says, Lord, today is a new day for me, and with you it can be a new day of abstinence. With you I can handle anything.
I ask for your protection today from anyone or anything that may interfere with my abstinence. And I'm asking now for your protection in case sometime during the day my desire to compulsively eat becomes stronger than my desire to abstain. I know that I am powerless over food and that my life can become unmanageable again. I now turn my life and will over to you. That prayer is magical. And I can go anywhere, anywhere on this planet, a free man, happy, joyous, and free, by the grace of God. I think that's it, right? Thank you.